Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
What happens when the state of Florida takes over a troubled county school district? The short answer, no one really knows.
Constitutionally and in law, school districts are responsible for their schools and their district.
Also this week, higher workers' comp rates for businesses and higher premiums for some property insurance policyholders. Florida regulators are considering both.
Unfortunately, what is not stable in Florida right now are the trends in water damage costs.
We'll also hear about the not altogether harmonious meeting of survivors and families of those who died at the infamous Dozier School for Boys, and how Florida archaeologists are scrambling to save ancient treasures from rising waters. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. As last week's Capitol Report was going on the air, Lynn Hatter had breaking news about a deeply troubled rural school district that's facing a takeover of sorts by state government. Many of Florida's rural school districts are in trouble, and nowhere is the crisis more apparent than in North Florida's Jefferson County. The district only has about 800 students left and has been consistently at the bottom of the heap when it comes to academics. Now it's in financial trouble. But as Lynn Hatter tells us, this isn't the first time. And this isn't the only rural school district in Florida that's at risk.
This is my second year, and we've made a lot of changes, and hopefully they'll pay off for our kids, because we failed them, and we have failed them in the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years.
2 years ago, Jefferson County School Superintendent Al Cooksey was hopeful his district was heading for a turnaround.
This is an exciting year. We're going to see what we did last year, the changes we made then, and hopefully they'll continue to help our kids get a better education.
This was the first day of school. Cooksey was still newly elected, and there were new administrators in place. But today, the district finds itself facing the same problems that have plagued it for more than a decade. Crumbling infrastructure, high teacher, principal, and administrative turnover, a shrinking student population, chronically low-performing schools. The result?
If this were a business, it's already gone bankrupt.
John Padgett sits on the State Board of Education, and he made that comment in July as Cooksey stood before the board, laying out the district's woes.
On that, I don't know what we're going to do. That's why I came down here and sat all day.
The State Education Board is now intervening financially. Members have thrown out suggestions. Convert Jefferson into a charter school district. Merge it with a neighbor. Then there's Board Chairwoman Marva Johnson's question.
I'm curious, is there a mechanism for a district to be taken over?
Constitutionally and in law, school districts are responsible for their schools and their district.
The short answer is no, says State Education Commissioner Pam Stewart, though there could be opportunity for partnerships between systems. This is the second time in 8 years Jefferson has found itself in financial distress. Students that have had the means to leave have done so. They're enrolled in neighboring Leon and Wakulla County schools, private schools in Jefferson, even Thomasville, Georgia. Students that remain are those who can't afford to go anywhere else. Jefferson County Commissioner Betsy Barfield says people are fed up.
They are truly disgusted with how far down our school system has gone, and they no longer have confidence that it could be fixed with the current path that has been taken.
The state funds schools based on the number of kids enrolled, and the departures, largely due to school choice laws, have been crippling. Jefferson County is also the worst performing academically in the state. Its situation is critical, but its problems are not unique. Five counties to the west is Liberty. Its county commission and its sheriff recently sparred before the Florida cabinet over funding. The sheriff, a constitutional officer, says his budget is too low. County Attorney Robin Myers says the county just doesn't have the money.
Our median household income is $36,000. That's with two people working. I say that because we have the lowest unemployment rate in the state. Every one of our citizens that can work is working, and everyone that we can tax, we are taxing to the fullest extent possible. So I guess the question I have is, where do we come up with the money to give the sheriff?
Most of Liberty County is protected land. It has few jobs, few industries, and it doesn't collect much in property taxes because many of its homes are under the state property tax cap, with additional breaks for seniors. It's a similar story in Gadsden County, where there are schools for sale. And that's also true for Jefferson.
I have said for the last two or three years, we are facing a crisis, if you will, in our small rural counties.
North Florida State Senator Bill Monford's district has nearly a dozen rural counties.
And it's not just education, it's health care, it's transportation, it's infrastructure. Never before in the history of the state have we seen such a diverse set of circumstances between mid and large size counties and our small rural counties. Small rural counties have taken it on the chin now.
Florida's rural counties and its schools are struggling, Monford says. And in the case of Jefferson, it may be time for a legislative intervention. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida's insurance regulators are considering two major rate increases. Nick Evans reports the moves would raise rates for workers' compensation insurance and property insurance with the state-backed company Citizens.
Court rulings and water claims are driving the rate hikes, insurers say. And across 2 days of public hearings, they worked hard to make their case before the Office of Insurance Regulation. The new meetings mark the first major undertakings in the tenure of David Altmaier, the new head of OIR.
It's certainly two very important decisions that we'll have to make. But you know, when you go into a job like this, you recognize that there's going to be decisions of this nature that arise.
And he explains the concerns aren't new. Insurers have been complaining about rising water claims, and workers' comp cases have been wending their way through the courts for years.
We knew they were coming, and we knew that they may cause some significant rate increases, and so we were geared up for that, and it's something I knew about going into the job, and so we'll just deal with this to the best that we can and move forward.
The first issue to come before the OIR panel was workers' compensation. After two court cases, Castellanos and Westfall, a number of reforms have been thrown out. The National Council on Compensation Insurance files rate requests for a number of major carriers in the state, and they believe those cases necessitate big increases. Here's Actuary Jay Rosen.
The pending rate filing is comprised of three main components, the first of which is the first-year impact of the Castellanos decision with an impact of plus 15%. The second is an update to the medical fee schedule, plus 1.8%, and then finally the Westfall decision, plus 2.2%. For an overall combined impact of 19.6%.
The largest chunk of that comes from the Castellanos decision, which tore up a state-mandated formula for attorneys' fees. NCCI officials say the fee schedule cut back on attorney involvement and brought premiums down from the highest in the country to the middle of the pack. Now, Division Executive for Florida Linda Lovegren says attorneys are running ads to solicit business.
The number of spots were up, and the average spend per month were also up, indicating presumably a willingness now to take more workers' comp cases since the Castellanos decision at the more generous fee levels.
Business interests like the Florida Chamber, the Florida Roofing and Sheet Metal Contractors Association, and Walmart all complained about the rising rates, but they criticized attorneys rather than insurers. That said, the rate proposal got some pushback from Mark Tobey, the attorney who represented Castellanos in the Supreme Court.
Tell me any other business where if you make a mistake, your business doesn't have to absorb that. They're asking for a 15% increase just on Castellanos alone to be passed on to the employers who did nothing wrong. The carriers are the ones making these decisions.
Thursday, OIR took up a rate proposal from Citizens Insurance, the state-backed insurer of last resort. President Barry Gilway says the past few years have put the company in a strong position, As book of business continues to shrink, a new clearinghouse appears to be working, and surplus accounts are sitting near $7.5 billion.
Citizens also benefited from major reductions in worldwide reinsurance costs. And of course, we have an unprecedented number of years without a major event, which has certainly allowed us to build, you know, surplus to that $7.5 billion level.
So why would Citizens be asking for a nearly 7% average rate increase?
Unfortunately, what is not stable in Florida right now are the trends in water damage costs.
That's Citizens Chief Risk Officer John Rollins. He argues water claims, and specifically those with an assignment of benefit, are driving costs upward. According to Rollins, an ordinary claim would come in at about $8,000. But with an assignment?
You see a total spike in costs. You see about a very consistent factor of four, $30,000 to $35,000 per claim.
The way it works is a homeowner gives a third party, usually the business doing repairs, the right to work directly with the insurance company. Those negotiations often involve public adjusters or attorneys. Insurers, both public and private, complain assignments are hurting their business and could result in higher premiums, like the one Citizens is currently requesting. But Chief Altmaier is looking for a balance, calling the issue delicate.
The assignment of benefits mechanism is something that we believe has value for consumers, and it's a mechanism that should probably stay as a mechanism that consumers can utilize when it's appropriate. And I think what makes it a delicate situation is that we have identified loopholes in that particular system that could perhaps be driving up insurance rates and claim costs for insurance companies inappropriately.
In addition to public testimony on the proposed rate increases, Altmaier's office is taking comment via email. The comment period ends for workers' comp rates on August 23rd and on September 1st for Citizens Insurance. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Floridians across the state are already affected by sea level rise and inconvenienced by so-called nuisance flooding. But for the state's archaeologists, the changing tides pose a threat to history itself.
And even with a 2-foot rise, we're still pretty stable as long as there's no storm activity. But once we get to a 6-foot rise, the entire site is inundated with water.
We'll get the latest about location of a memorial associated with the infamous Dozier School for Boys.
I think that we need to be factoring it in on, is it going to be Tampa, is it going to be Tallahassee or Jackson County?
And state wildlife officials say bear-resistant trash cans are an important tool for managing human-bear conflicts.
Unsecured trash cans to bears are like going to an all-you-can-eat country buffet.
Climate change in Florida is already taking its toll in the form of rising temperatures, extreme weather events, and shifting tides. The changes are sending archaeologists scrambling to protect the state's historical resources. Kate Payne traveled to the country's oldest city to tell this story.
On a sweaty summer morning in St. Augustine, a group of archaeologists gathered at one of the state's oldest and most iconic landmarks. The Castillo de San Marcos is a more than 330-year-old limestone fort perched on the edge of the water in a city first established by the Spanish in 1565. The Castillo offers commanding views of the Matanzas River and, beyond that, the Atlantic Ocean.
By the way, the area that you're in right now is what's called the Ravelin. It is the defense for the one entry point into the Castillo. So this was our line of defense, our first line of defense for the main entry point into the Castillo. We're going to head down the Castillo. We're going to walk through.
That's James Crutchfield, a National Park Service guide at the fort. He's also the last in a line of historic masons and one of the only people left in the city who knows how to cut the hunks of coquina stone that make up the fort's walls.
The coquina is a very great material for protecting the fort in an attack for cannonballs or muskets. Coquina is not a great material when it comes to fighting the everyday elements such as rain. And so what's happening is the water sheet.
Crutchfield, like the fort itself, is struggling to keep up with the changing tides. St. Augustine and coastal and low-lying areas across the state are already plagued by so-called nuisance flooding. Florida's notorious summer showers combined with high tides are enough to flood the streets in some cities. And in a town where it's difficult to dig a hole without hitting some 17th century artifact, there's a lot at stake. 100 archaeologists, architects, and urban planners gathered in St. Augustine to make a plan.
So when we look at a 1 foot rise, we already are seeing pretty significant effects to our coastal regions. And then once we get to a 6 foot sea level rise, you can see that most of our coastal cities are at least partially flooded, if not completely flooded. So when we're talking about archaeology in this area...
That's archaeologist Rachel Kangas. She monitors Native American mounds on Pine Island in southwest Florida. She's uncovered, among other things, a 1,000-year-old fishing net made out of palm fibers. But why bother with archaic tools and ancient trash piles? Shouldn't basic infrastructure, roads, and wastewater plants take precedence? Archaeologist and outgoing University of West Florida President Judy Bentz made this argument.
But no one else can tell the human story except us. And we know that. And it is something that is deeply important to who we are as not just humans, but as American citizens, and certainly as anthropologists and archaeologists. We're very special people. It doesn't mean we're better or we're worse than anybody else. But we have a very special view that we look back into the past and deduce what must have happened.
Bentz and her colleagues believe it's vital to understand past civilizations and their impact on the present. There's even evidence of previous residents of St. Augustine fortifying their city against the changing tides hundreds of years ago.
There could be multiple tidal events shown in the archaeological record, and you could see multiple floor levels that show that they were rebuilt right on site. So the materials that were used for construction, such as, say, coquina buildings,
statewide, the Florida Public Archaeology Network is monitoring more than 29,000 buildings and nearly 4,000 sites endangered by sea level rise. Some members, like Rachel Kangas, are already seeing sites disappear.
So when we talk about sea level rise at Pineland, right now it's fairly stable, and even with a 2 foot rise, we're still pretty stable as long as there's no storm activity. But once we get to a 6 foot rise, the entire site is inundated with water, again with the exception of those two nice tall mounds.
Many coastal communities are establishing living shorelines, beds of oysters and seagrass that act as a natural buffer. Some private homeowners in St. Augustine have taken to simply raising their houses, some by 10 feet or more. But back at the Castillo, that just isn't an option. And the city isn't keen on building a large, obtrusive seawall either. Their current wall can withstand a Category 1 hurricane, and they think that'll do for now. In the meantime, Crutchfield and his team are documenting everything, preserving what they can, and enjoying the view of the water. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Final recommendations on a memorial for the unclaimed remains uncovered on the Dozier School for Boys grounds are now heading to the Florida legislature. But as Sasha Cordner reports, during the final meeting of the panel tasked with making those suggestions, tensions were pretty high.
The Dozier Task Force has two goals as outlined by Secretary of State Ken Detzner.
Identify a final resting place for the remains, and creation of a memorial to honor the memory of the boys who lived and died at the Arthur G. School for Boys in Marianna.
It's alleged that there was a history of abuse at the now-closed North Florida Reform School, and many boys were buried on those grounds because of it. So far, several families have come forward to claim the remains of their ancestors uncovered through a dig by researchers years ago, but there are still unclaimed remains. And that's why a new state law set up the task force to determine the future of those remains. At the first meeting of the Dozier Task Force, passions ran high. While one side wanted the memorial for the unclaimed remains to be on the Dozier grounds in Marianna, others argued they wanted the memorial at a more prominent location that could draw larger crowds. And similar arguments were made again during the task force's final meeting Friday. Stephen Britt is the nephew of Robert Stevens, who died at Dozier. While Britt initially wanted the memorial on the Dozier grounds, he later changed his mind.
I'm sure that the people of Jackson County, as well as Marianna, don't want the remains back in their county. But we in Gadsden County, we are fully willing to accept those remains if the state is willing to work with us. My uncle knew some of those boys that died before he was himself murdered. Some of those boys who were murdered after my uncle knew my uncle. Therefore, it's a more personal item to me and my family.
In the end, three locations were considered: Marianna, the site of the Dozier School for Boys, Tallahassee, the state's capital, and Tampa, near where many alleged survivors live and where the researchers who uncovered the remains are. At this meeting, the public was allowed to weigh in, and Carol Ellis says there should be two memorials. She's the daughter of a former ward of the school, and she says her family has been negatively affected by Dozier for decades.
Please settle this today. Have a memorial here in Marianna. Have a more memorial in Tallahassee so we can see the good, bad, and the ugly. But let's close this and bring us all to a close for everybody in this room and the families.
Later, the task force agreed to at least have the reburial in Tallahassee and a memorial in Tallahassee and Marianna, but some wanted the White House building moved to Tallahassee as a place of living history, like Kevin Wood, an engineer who's worked with former wards of the Dozier School. The White House is the place where much of the alleged physical and sexual abuse occurred.
I have been inside that White House, and when you walk into the opening, the front door, the terror that I felt, and I never even went through that building as a White House boy, that is something that other people need to experience. When you walk in there, the concrete jail cells, the bars, the bench where the boys would wait to be beaten.
But Jerry Cooper, who sits on the task force, disagrees. A former ward of the school and president of the so-called White House Boys, he was also against a memorial placed in front of the White House building. Essentially, he'd like a formal apology from the state and to see that White House building destroyed.
To memorialize the White House, to leave it standing, it serves no purpose, sir. And let me say why. A lot of these kids, 10 years, 11 years, 12 years old, were taken into that building. We know about the beatings. But when I learned myself personally and the rest of the men that sexual favors were even passed out in this building to keep from being beaten, that's the last straw.
Ultimately, the task force agreed the unclaimed remains be reburied in Tallahassee, and there will be two memorials, one in Tallahassee and one in Jackson County. That would be for the Dozier children as well as for the children and two staffers who were victims of a 1914 dorm fire. They also agreed that the location of the reinterment of the unclaimed remains be determined by the Florida legislature. And their recommendations will now be sent to the Department of State as well as the governor, the cabinet, and state lawmakers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, wildlife officials saw a slight reduction in 2015 of calls received about bears in neighborhoods. But the number still tops about 6,000. And while a bear hunt has been taken off the table this year, Regan McCarthy reports officials have other efforts underway to reduce human-bear conflicts.
Garbage is one of the main draws attracting bears from the woods and into neighborhoods. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission Chair Brian Yablonsky explains that's because what might seem like a smelly heap to you seems a little different to a bear.
Unsecured trash cans to bears are like going to an all-you-can-eat country buffet. It's all easy and it's all spread out for you, you know, good for the taking. So, and that's actually when the trouble starts with bears. And these interactions can escalate. We can have injuries or deaths to livestock, pets. We've had human injuries related to this directly as well.
And the FWC has been working to crack down on that. The legislature recently approved new feeding rules that wildlife officials hope will help them stop people from feeding bears, even if it's unintentional. David Telesco is the state's bear management coordinator. He says the new rules let wildlife officials focus on education first.
The new feeding rules passed in 2015. It basically says that you are not allowed to intentionally feed a bear. And if you're unintentionally feeding a bear, it's illegal if you get a notification. So you have to get a notification first. If I'm putting my trash out in a manner that's causing bears to come to it, I'm not in violation until I've received that notification first.
And Yablonski says there are a number of steps citizens can take to keep their trash from becoming a bear attractor.
I mean, one of the obvious things is if you know your trash is coming the next day or the next morning, you keep your trash inside your garage the whole week and the night before, and you don't bring it out until the day of or the morning of when trash pickup. Something as simple as that can go a long way into a lot of these communities where there are conflicts.
Or Telesco says another solution is a bear-resistant trash can.
The idea behind these cans are that a bear cannot get a claw or a tooth in anywhere where they can actually crank and produce pressure. Bears are extremely strong. They can pretty much peel a door of a vehicle even if it's locked. So we have to make sure that this is sealed up.
Telesco says bear-resistant cans have reinforced lids and are strong enough to withstand a bear turning them over and jumping on their sides.
But what happens is you put your hand over here. There's actually a demo showing how you do it. You put your hand in here, you lift the latch, and that's what this is here. Here's your latching mechanism. As soon as I drop it, this clip's going to hit and it's going to lock it. So automatically locking lid. I drop the can, I don't have to do anything else, and it's back into the lock position.
But bear-resistant trash bins can be expensive. A 96-gallon can, similar to the one Telesco is demonstrating, sells online for more than $200. But wildlife officials are working to make them more readily available. Thomas Eason is the FWC's Director of Species and Habitat Management.
We see this as a four-way partnership between government, mainly FWC, but also the legislature and governor, with the Waste Pro companies, as well as with local municipalities, counties, and the homeowner. And so our model is to work across all four of those partnerships to create an affordable and effective tool in that regard.
Eason says the commission has created cost-sharing grants intended to help make bear-resistant cans more affordable for community members. The commission has also just signed an agreement with the company Waste Pro, which Eason hopes will help. The agreement stipulates Waste Pro must make bear-resistant trash cans available in a timely manner or allow customers to modify their cans to make them more resistant. It also specifies the FWC must continue education efforts and enforce the state's feeding rules. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.